This is a podcast from the University of Manchester's John Dalby Centre for Astrophysics. For more information, see johncast.net.
George and I are here with Professor Matt Griffin, who's been in George O'Bank Centre for Astrophysics today, speaking about the future of far infrared extragalactic astronomy from Herschel and beyond. Over to you, George, because you have an extensive list of questions.
Now, I've worked with Matt for a few years on the Herschel Space Observatory. Just going to start with asking Matt, first of all, give a brief description of what the Herschel Space Observatory is.
Well, Herschel, as you say, is a space observatory, and that means it's designed to operate above the Earth's atmosphere, and it's very difficult and expensive launching anything into space. So one only tries to do that when one has to. So Herschel is observing in a range of wavelengths roughly a few hundred times longer than the wavelength of visible light, and most of the radiation that we're looking for can't be seen from the ground because it's absorbed by the Earth's atmosphere. So if we want to observe it, we have to go into space. And it's important to observe it because when we look at out at the universe at these wavelengths, we see a different side of it to what we see if we look with an optical telescope. Most of what you can see with an optical telescope is emission by stars or planets in our own neighborhood. And that's very interesting. It tells us a great deal about the universe, but all of the objects we see are essentially grown up. If we want to see how stars form, either in our own galaxy or in distant galaxies, then we have a problem with optical radiation because it's not emitted by these objects, and even if it is, it gets absorbed by big, thick clouds of gas and dust that surround the regions where stars are forming. So Herschel's scientific theme is to look at the birth processes of stars, and that's why we have to do that from space, because we can't observe at the relevant wavelengths from the ground.
Now, what's your personal involvement been with the Herschel Space Observatory, and when did you first get involved with the Herschel Space Observatory?
Well, I started working on Herschel in the form of participating in various study groups in the early 1990s. The observatory was first conceived probably early to mid-1980s, and as with most large astronomical observatories, it takes a long time to get from conceiving the idea to actually executing it in flying the telescope, in this case several decades. So when I started, various studies of different concepts for the mission were being proposed and evaluated, and it went through various evolutions, a bit like a Hollywood script. You know, the film that actually gets made in the end bears little resemblance to the first version of the script that people thought up. It's very similar with space observatories. So we worked on various studies, evaluating the concepts, trying to make it better, trying to fit in within the budget and the technical constraints. And that took a long time, and eventually it became a fully-fledged project when we sorted out the design and we knew we could do it. We started the design, detailed design and building process in 1998, and then it essentially took another decade to build and test the observatory before the launch, which was in May 2009.
So now you're the lead scientist for the Spire instrument. Did you start working on the Spire instrument in 1998?
Yes, in fact, I'd started working on the Spire concept quite a bit before that. In parallel with studying the spacecraft, we had to study what was called the model payload. That was a set of possible instruments that would do the necessary scientific job, and it became clear that what we needed were three instruments, all very complex and sophisticated, and it was clear that each one of them would have to be built by an international team. And so to be ready, we knew it would take 10 years to build the instrument and to test it. To be ready to start in 1998, we actually started assembling the team and working on some preliminary designs and so on in the mid-1990s, probably about 1995. So we were ready to hit the ground running, as it were, with building the instrument straight away.
So can you tell us a little bit about what the Spire instrument is specifically and what makes it so special?
Well, Spire is designed to do the kind of observations that most astronomical instruments do. And those observations mainly fall into two different kinds. One is taking pictures. So Spire has a camera, and it takes pictures in three different colors, and those colors can be combined together to produce a false color image. And those colors are analogous to the colors of visible light. So if you have a camera, it can take pictures in three different colors simultaneously, and they can be combined to produce a composite color image of whatever you're looking at. And we want to do that at Herschel wavelengths just as well as we want to do it in the visible from other telescopes. So that's the one kind of observation, and from that you can tell a great deal. You can tell what's there, you can tell what kind of structure it has. From the information in the three colors, you can learn about things like the temperature and the density of what you're looking at. So we can start to do physics on what we see. The other kind of observation is called spectroscopy, and that's where the light is broken up into its constituent wavelengths and studied in detail. And that's very useful because different atoms and molecules have their own special signatures. There are certain wavelengths of light where they like to emit or absorb radiation. So if one sees that happening, then it's an immediate indication of what's there. And by studying in detail the spectral features emitted by atoms and molecules, you can learn about things like their composition, the temperature of the gas, the density of the gas, whether it's moving towards you or away from you. You can start to learn all kinds of detailed physical properties of the region you're looking at. So those are the two basic kinds of observations that astronomers can do. They like to take pictures to see what's there, and then they like to home in on certain spectral features in order to learn about the physics of whatever source they're looking at. And SPIRE does that in a way that's basically the same as an instrument working at optical wavelengths on a ground-based telescope.
Okay. So I spent a little bit of time preparing for this interview, looking on the ESA website for the original science goals of the Herschel Space Observatory. This is kind of entertaining in my opinion, just because sometimes scientists say they're going to go do something, and then they actually end up doing something else, or they discover that what they want to try to do, they couldn't originally do. So I just wanted to run through these really quickly and see if you can tell me whether or not Herschel Space Observatory has actually achieved these goals, or if it did better or if it did worse. And then after this, I'm going to ask where the things that nobody thought about before the launch of Herschel, which turned out to be really interesting once Herschel began working. So the first, the original goals, the website said that Herschel would detect emission from the earliest galaxies to form in the universe. Have we been seeing that with Herschel?
That's probably a little bit of an exaggeration, but I think Herschel's done quite well in that respect. When galaxies form, a large number of stars are forming at the same time. And as I said before, when stars are forming, this occurs inside very large clouds of gas and dust that are opaque at visible wavelengths, but Herschel can penetrate the gas and dust and see inside. So Herschel's very useful for looking at galaxy formation, where we like to try and catch the galaxies in the act of forming most of their stars. And also with Herschel, because of its sensitivity, we can see very distant objects. And so Herschel has managed to do more or less what was predicted. We can see the star formation occurring in galaxies way back into the early history of the universe, when it was only maybe 10% of its current age. I don't think the story is complete there yet. What Herschel has done in its first 2 years of operation is to do lots of survey observations whereby large areas of sky have been systematically mapped, producing a huge volume of data. And so far only a small amount of that has been studied in detail. But already we're beginning to see some objects which are at great distances, and we're beginning to start to study them in depth. So I think Herschel has more or less achieved that ambition, although there are probably younger objects that are even further away that we have not actually detected and that we won't. So whether it was the very earliest objects is probably not literally true, but I think in spirit we've managed to tick that one.
Another thing that was stated was that Herschel would find cold gas clouds that would be the gas clouds that would eventually collapse to form stars.
Yes, indeed. That's one of the main goals of Herschel, and that one has been, I think, achieved, and has been achieved in a very spectacular way. In our own galaxy, stars are forming today, and stars like the Sun are forming, and one of the objectives of Herschel was to investigate that process and learn more about it, both in order to understand it in general and also to get a better picture of how the Sun and its planetary system were created 4.5 billion years ago. So the same thing's going on today. And Herschel's sensitivity, and in particular its ability to map large areas of sky, has proven to be very useful in that respect, because these clouds are very large, and they're quite diffuse, and it's very difficult to map the emission unless one has a very stable observatory, and that's what Herschel has provided. And it's shown us the structure of what we call the interstellar medium. That's the material between the stars, the gas and the dust out of which new stars might be forming or might form in the future. We can now see that material with Herschel in great detail, and we're beginning to understand its structure and how the star formation process begins and how it proceeds and how the final stars emerge. So I think Herschel has made a huge advance in that respect.
Another stated goal was that Herschel would find more dust disks around other stars. Have we seen that with Herschel?
Indeed we have. Dust disks around stars were a major scientific theme of a previous observatory called Spitzer. And Spitzer detected these dust disks. Herschel has followed that up and has managed to make improved measurements because Herschel has a bigger telescope than Spitzer, so it has a higher magnification. It produces more detailed images. And so one of the most important galactic projects for Herschel has been to look in detail at these disks, and we can see them much more clearly with Herschel, particularly with a PAX instrument. The Spire instrument is working at longer wavelengths. At shorter wavelengths, we get better images. And the PAX instrument has taken some fantastic pictures of these disks, and it's also able to see them in quite large numbers so that we can start to investigate their statistical properties as well as homing in on individual ones and looking at them in detail. So that's going to be another sort of major success story of Herschel.
I think along these lines, even though I'm asking questions as though I don't know anything, I've been particularly impressed with the images of the Vega debris disk that Bruce Sibthorpe has produced in his research.
Yes, and that's something that came more or less straight out of the box in one of the earliest scientific observations of Herschel. When we were building Herschel, we knew it was very complicated, and we would have been quite pleased if two-thirds of it had worked, because that's the nature of a space observatory. You're always pushing the technology, and you can't fix anything if it goes wrong, and the launch is a bit of an ordeal for the system. And we expected a few things to break, a few things not to work properly. But in effect, practically everything works perfectly, and we were able to do these fantastic science observations in the very first months of operation.
Another stated goal was examining the chemistry of comets and other things within the solar system.
Yes, again, Herschel has very wide-ranging capabilities. Its primary science goals were star formation in our own galaxy and in distant galaxies. But its suite of instruments is such that astronomers who are interested in all kinds of other things can also use it, including people who are interested in the solar system. We can learn a great deal about objects in the solar system by sending probes, landers and orbiters and so on, and we're all familiar with that. But we can also learn a great deal by remote sensing. And Herschel has remote sensing capabilities because it's operating in a poorly explored wavelength range that can tell us new things about the atmospheres of the planets and about comets. For instance, when we look at a comet with Herschel, we can use the cameras to look at the dust shroud that surrounds the nucleus, and we can use the spectrometers to study the gas cloud that surrounds the nucleus, which has been boiled off by the intense light of the sun. And as a comet approaches the sun and recedes, then the rate at which gas boils off increases and then decreases again. And we can follow that with Herschel, and the spectrometers can allow us to determine what's there, how fast it's boiling off the nucleus, what composition it has. And that's very interesting because it's thought that, for instance, the water that's now on the Earth might have arisen from a phase in the early evolution of the planet when it was bombarded by comets. And so if we look at the composition of water in comets and compare it to the composition of water on Earth, we can test that theory.
And then related goal of the Herschel Space Observatory was that it would detect exotic molecules in space. Has Herschel achieved this?
It has. It's detected a few molecules that were previously unknown. I wouldn't describe that as one of its major achievements. Exotic molecules tend to be ones that contain many atoms, and such molecules don't necessarily show themselves most prominently in the Herschel wavelength range. Nevertheless, it's seen a few that haven't been seen before. And also in Herschel's spectra, there are lots of unidentified spectral features. Many of these, I think, over the years will be pinned down as, you know, additional spectral features of molecules that we already know are there, and perhaps some of them will be new ones.
Now, this is just a list of things that people thought that Herschel would do before Herschel was launched. Is there anything that I haven't mentioned which you think is particularly spectacular, which Herschel has done, which nobody anticipated that Herschel could do before launch?
Perhaps if we'd thought a bit more carefully, we would have been able to predict this. But we didn't think it was going to be very good for doing spectroscopy, studying the spectral features of gas for very distant galaxies. because we thought that the signal would be too faint. So we weren't really expecting much in that respect. However, there's a phenomenon that occurs in astronomy that can give us a bit of a boost, and that's where a gravitational lens makes the signal stronger. What this requires is that we look at an object, and right between us and the object, on exactly the same line of sight, there is a large galaxy. And that large galaxy acts as a sort of a magnification lens by bending the light from the source in the background around it and giving us a magnified image. And these instances are not very common. You have to have the two galaxies in very precisely the exact same line of sight. But with Herschel, we studied large areas of sky, and we've managed to identify a few cases where this occurs. And then, if we point our spectrometer, we can measure the spectrum from the distant galaxy, because in effect we have an additional telescope between Herschel and it. And that's allowed us to probe much more deeply into the universe, into the early universe, and use our spectrometers on objects we thought we'd never be able to see. That was a very pleasant surprise. Another pleasant surprise to some people, although those of us working on the instrument and on the observatory knew that it would happen if we got things right, was the image quality produced by the Herschel cameras that allows us to see the turbulent and complex nature of the material in our own galaxy in a way that was never really appreciated beforehand. The images that we see are as good as we expected, and I think some people who weren't so familiar with the work that we'd been doing on the instrument were pleasantly surprised by that too.
Interesting. Now, in the last podcast, you mentioned that you would hope that a lot of people in the future would use Herschel data, even long after Herschel stopped operating, to continue to do science with the data. So it's not just people working with the science now, but people working with the data for a much longer period of time. Is this something that you've been seeing other people do?
This is the most important aspect of the project from my perspective. All the efforts that we made over many years to build the instrument had the sole purpose of getting the data. And now that we have the data, people are actively working on it at the moment, getting their publications out, getting new results, and that's great. But the amount and quality of data we have are such that it will take a very long time. It'll take decades to do justice to it. So the real scientific benefit and legacy of Herschel will only be realized if we manage to make the data available to future astronomers in a form that's easy to use. So, for instance, I can imagine 10 years from now or 15 years from now, a research astronomer might want to use some Herschel data. They won't want to learn about how the instruments worked. They might not even care that there were two cameras instead of one. They just want to get the data from those cameras and use it to do their science or to combine it with observations made by other telescopes. And we're working very hard at the moment to try and make sure that that's what we do. We will put all the data in an archive which will be easy to use, easy to access, easy to understand. And if we do that properly, then the benefit of Herschel would extend over decades rather than just its own operational lifetime. The programs that Herschel has undertaken have all been carefully planned with that in mind. The whole idea was that the first half of the mission would be dominated by these big surveys to produce huge data sets, and the people involved in the survey observations would get their payoff by, you know, being able to do some quick science, but then the data would be put into the public domain, accessible to everybody to use for many years into the future. And I think that's going to work quite well. It'll still take a little bit of care and attention to detail to make sure that the archive of the data is as good as it needs to be.
Do you think people listening to this podcast, amateur astronomers or general space enthusiasts who may not have a PhD in astronomy, could go to those archives and download the data themselves?
That's an interesting question. The archives will contain usable maps. So, again, if we do the job right, one of the archive products will be an image, and there should be nothing in principle to stop an amateur astronomer from downloading such an image directly. In addition to that, many of the images taken by Herschel are going to be made available by ESA, and already are being made available by ESA, on a special repository which they have set up, which might be a little bit more digestible for the casual observer.
So, talked about what Herschel has done. Now, Herschel was launched in April of 2009?
That's right. No, May 2009.
May 2009. And when will Herschel cease to operate? And then what will happen once it ceases to operate?
Well, the Herschel instruments all have to be cooled to very low temperature to work at all three of them. And that's achieved by having a big tank of liquid helium on board, which achieves very low temperatures. But the helium slowly boils off into space, and it will all be gone. It will run out, we expect, in the spring of 2013. So 4 years or slightly less after the launch. And unfortunately, when the helium runs out, none of the Herschel instruments will function at all, and the mission will end. What happens to the Herschel spacecraft after that hasn't been decided yet. Like all spacecraft these days, it will have to be parked or put into some known orbit where the chances of it ever crashing into the Earth in an uncontrolled way are zero. So what happens to it depends on ESA. What we want to happen to it is that it be crashed into the moon, because that would be quite a spectacular way to sign off, as it were. Whether or not ESA are willing to do that, we'll have to wait and see.
And then after you crash Herschel into the moon, what will come next for people who are interested in infrared astronomy?
Well, infrared astronomy is only in its infancy. We've been studying the visible light from stars for centuries with the naked eye and with increasingly powerful telescopes. And we know a great deal about the side of the story of the universe that visible light has to tell us. But infrared astronomy is a very young subject, and Herschel is really only a pioneering mission to get us started in trying to understand the obscured universe that we can't see in the visible. And it will need to be followed up. We can already see from the data that we need to follow it up with a more powerful observatory. And the next one, and hopefully a sequence, will be called SPICA, the Space Infrared Telescope for Cosmology and Astrophysics, which is a mission being planned by Japan. It will have substantial international participation, so Europe will make a contribution to it too. And that's a mission which will have a telescope about the same size as the Herschel telescope, but with a big advantage, and that advantage is that the SPICA telescope will be very cold. The Herschel telescope has a temperature about 80 degrees Kelvin, 80 degrees above absolute zero, which is very cold, but not as cold as we would have liked. The SPICA telescope will have a temperature only a few degrees above absolute zero. Now, that doesn't seem like a huge difference, but actually it does make an enormous difference to the sensitivity. And with SPICA, we'll be able to do the same things that we can currently do with Herschel, but on objects which are far more distant, and we'll be able to do it on a lot more of them. So the next generation observatory following Herschel will be essentially something similar, but several hundred times more sensitive, and that will allow us to extend our knowledge of the universe out to much earlier times.
Great. Oh, thank you for talking with us today.
It's been a pleasure. Thank you.